I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Kelly Armstrong, one of the most prolific and successful writers ever, a number one New York Times bestseller, no less, joins me now. Her latest book has just been published, Omens. It's a new series from the writer who's given us the Other World series, 13 books since 2001 that have sold millions of copies around the world. The Darkest Powers and Darkness Rising series, which have yielded popular books in the teen paranormal genre. She's also written two books thus far in the Nadia Stafford series of crime thrillers. This new book, Omens, takes us to a small town called Canesville in Illinois. The central figure in the book is a 24-year-old named Olivia Taylor Jones, who seems to have a charmed life, the only daughter of a wealthy family, an Ivy League education, philanthropy, and an engagement to a tech firm CEO with political ambitions. That's all fine until she discovers that she's adopted and her parents are serial killers. I'll get Ms. Armstrong to tell us as much as possible where the book goes from there, and I'll ask her about her prodigious career thus far. She's at the top of her game. Her website is at kellyarmstrong.com. This new book is published by Random House. Kelly Armstrong joins me from here in Vancouver in late August. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Kelly Armstrong. Ms. Armstrong, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is I read somewhere that this is the first book tour that you've done across Canada in a while? Is that
in
right?
In a while, yes. Yeah. I had done a few early on, none as lengthy as this one, but I did a fair bit of Canadian touring early on, and then it was kind of you hit the point of saying, okay, everyone has seen me and is sick of me, let's take some time off.
But have you spent much time here in BC?
I come out fairly regularly. I was out to Surrey in June for a library visit, and out to Vancouver for a library visit last fall.
It wasn't a part of The Rising, wasn't that set here?
It was, yes. Yeah. The Darkness Rising series is set primarily on Vancouver Island, and then the third book, The Rising, a big chunk of it is in Vancouver.
And do you find that if you set a book in Canada, say, that it doesn't matter for the audience outside of Canada?
It doesn't. I mean, in my experience, I've never had anyone say, I would have read that if it wasn't set in Canada. Certainly when I was younger and writing, I was told over and over again, you can't set books in Canada. American publishers won't buy them. American readers won't read them. Never had anyone say, it was great except for that Canadian setting.
Yeah. Yeah. So Canesville is in Illinois, right?
It is.
And it's a town that you've in case people listening or start looking it up, it's a town that you've created, right?
I've made it up, yeah.
Yeah. And so how far is it from Chicago, say?
It's about an hour outside Chicago, but it's relatively difficult to get through, which helps explain why it hasn't become a bedroom community.
Yeah. Now, small towns, some of your books, a majority of your books are set in small towns. Do you create the setting first, or is it the characters?
I usually create characters first, although I will certainly have in mind the setting. For example, Darkness Rising, that was a very small medical research town on Vancouver Island, so I knew that much. Small medical research town, but then I spun into characters. And for Canesville, I knew spooky small town, and I knew what the deep dark secret was. But beyond that, I then went into character first, and then did the two together.
And so, if this Canesville series, because this is the first book, Omens is, if it goes on beyond this book, you're able to, because it's a small town, create the setting further, flesh it out, right?
I am, and there is a lot of work that I do up front. So I have maps, I have history, I know what the backstory is, you know, where the town is located, what the geography is like, what Main Street looks like, much more than appears in the first book, and then I'm ready to go for future books.
That must be fun. That's like what's that video game where people create cities in the sort of
city, yeah,
you get to do that yourself, right?
I do, and yeah. it really is a lot of fun, especially for me coming up with the background of the town and sort of doing some of that history stuff.
Do you live in a small town yourself?
I live sort of between two, so I am between a town of 6,000 and a town of 12,000. So they're not as tiny as Canesville, but certainly there are towns in the area that size, so I can drive to them and say, here's what a town of 1,000 or 2,000 actually looks like.
And small towns have secrets, don't they? And they have a certain sensibility that you wouldn't get, say, in a city where we're in today, Vancouver.
Yeah. And certainly I can do a lot more with them. If I say there is this, a small town, and for your various reasons, it's not a bedroom community, and there are secrets there. It's much harder to do that in a city. You could have a little community that is like that, but the city would encroach on it so much that it's just much easier to do small town.
Now, Olivia, as I said in the introduction, she's got a pretty charmed life, and then it all goes to hell. How does she find out that her parents are serial killers?
Well, she finds out because the media finds out that somebody had sold the information to a web news site, and then she is besieged by the media, and that is when she first finds out. Her mother tries to tell her beforehand, but doesn't get very far before she finds out and is confronted with that, because it is the most notorious serial killers in that area.
So they were pretty well known. There was no inkling that she had no inkling that she was connected to them, right?
Well, she didn't even know she was adopted.
Yeah.
So she had been adopted when she was a couple of years old, and her parents covered that up because they had been abroad earlier and just say, look, we came home and we've got this 2-year-old daughter. So she grew up thinking she was their daughter. So it's that double whammy of not only are my parents not who I think they are, which is tough enough for her, but they are these notorious serial killers.
And so what sort of headspace do we find her in when the book starts? Is she questioning everything?
It certainly is. I mean, she's a pretty tough girl, but she certainly is going to start. And that is what I wanted to really explore. No matter, you know, you may have a fairly strong sense of self, and then that is going to be completely disrupted, and you're suddenly looking at everything you do. You know, what am I too cold? Do I have enough friends? Do I manipulate people? Everything that we might think of as a sociopath or a serial killer, do I have any of those traits? Because if both my parents were, it seems like there should be some kind of genetic component there.
Did you do much research in that side of science? Like, I mean, if habits and the sort are genetic?
I did. Yeah. I mean, a lot of that. My actual background, my bachelor's is in psychology, and my focus at the time was abnormal psych. So I'm able to use that a lot more than anyone would think when I'm developing characters in general, saying, if their background was like this, what would they grow up to be? But even more so for something like this, where I certainly had that basic background, the whole nature-nurture debate, and then could delve into it and, you know, researching what kind of proof is there for any sort of genetic component to this.
So this is a new series. Do you know how many books it'll be?
I am just last week finished the third.
I see.
The first draft, because I work very far ahead. So I started Omens 3 years ago, so it takes me about a year. So 3 years later, I'm just finishing the first draft of book three. When I started Omens, I thought it was a trilogy. By the time I wasn't far into book two, I knew that both the character arc and the story arc, the mystery arc for the town and Olivia's past were going to take me more than three. I'd love to get 5 or 6 books out of it. Of course, that's premature to say until we see how the first one does, but ideally that would be where I would love to go.
And so when you started 3 years ago, do you know how this ends for Olivia?
I certainly, when I start something like that, I know where I want to take the character, and I have a basic idea of the ending. And when I sold it, it was sold based on a general outline. And I can now go back and laugh at the outline, because it certainly sticks pretty much to it for book one. And then book two starts going off the rails. Book three's gone totally off the rails. And so where I pictured her ending up is adjacent to where she will ultimately end up, but things change as the characters develop, and I say, no, this would work much better than what I had in mind 3 years ago.
Where do you find inspiration for the books that you write? Because, I mean, you're quite a prolific writer, so, I mean, you're working awfully hard, and as you said a moment ago, you're working ahead, because, you know, you've got a book a year, or more than a book a year sometimes, right?
Yes.
Do you find that ideas come to you easily?
They do, and I say that is because I've been telling stories since before I was old enough to write them down. I grew up being a huge reader and was writing as soon as I could. So I have some very, very earliest stories. Grew up loving writing, loving telling stories in any format, and I've never lost that, so that by this point, coming up with ideas is not the problem. Having time to write them down would be the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Are there different demands on you as a writer when you're writing for, say, an adult audience, as you did in Omens, as opposed to if you're writing for a YA audience?
It's not as different as I would have thought before I started writing YA. I started writing YA because my daughter was hitting her teen years and eyeing my very adult books. And I said, no, here, let me write you something set in the same world, but with teens. And I expected that it would be a very different kind of story for a teen. And when I went out and read YA, contemporary YA, I saw that really the only difference was the age of the characters. The plots are as complex, the characters are as complex, the language is pretty much the same. What changes is the character, and they really have to be 15, 16. They can't have the skills or the experience of a 25-year-old and then say, well, they're 15. So that is the one little twist there, is I have to think, what would a 15, 16-year-old be able to do in that situation?
And the feedback that you get from YA readers, I mean, it's just as savvy, I'm assuming, as say, the emails you get from adult readers.
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, they can be some of the most critical thinkers. I mean, they can like, come up to me and say, I liked this, and I liked this, and this I'm not so sure on, and this, and because I find that with the teens, they're more willing to tell you what both worked and what didn't work for them. And they really do think that through. I can be talking to 12-year-olds who can say, this didn't work for me because of this. And it's really amazing.
I heard an interview you did with the CBC. I think it was in Ottawa or Toronto. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in passing that you have beta readers.
Yes.
How many of those do you have for a book?
So by the time I finished The Other World, I think I had about 9 in that series. And for the YA, I had 6. I sort of gather them as I go. And they're usually readers that I've had correspondence with and I've met someplace. I'll meet them at a convention or a writer's conference. And they will, you know, mention something. And they will hear that I have beta readers and ask to, you know, be one. And it works well for me because, for me, what a beta reader is, and it changes between writers, but for me, it means, once the book is what we would consider done, like at the copy, at a stage, it goes to them, and they're sort of able to get that final look at how it fits into the series. Does it work for them? Are there things that don't work? And better yet, they can help me find continuity errors. They can say, Kelly, in book 4, you did this, and now in book 11, you're saying this, which is great.
Yeah, and so they're obviously not the first pair of eyes that see you writing after you've written it. Does it change a great deal after, say, you do a first draft to the book that we have in our hands now?
It definitely does. I mean, I write a very fast first draft, but I would spend much longer editing. So it goes through edit after edit after edit. I mean, Omens, because it was the first in a series, I think probably went through about 6 rounds of editing. So constantly editing, adding stuff, subtracting stuff, winnowing it down to its form. And I have critique partners, other writers and that, who are sort of my first line, who see it before anyone, then my editors, then my, you know, daughter or writing friends, and then beyond that to beta readers. So So lots of people helping me get it looking as good as possible.
Yeah. You have on your website, I noticed, an FAQ of writing tips.
Mm-hmm.
And one suspects that you do because you regularly get these questions on email from fans, from other aspiring writers. You seem, in reading the answers to the questions, quite encouraging. Were there specific people who encouraged you when you started your career?
There were so many people that did. Most importantly, my parents. I mean, there is nothing like having your parents support you. My parents are not writers. They are not. They do not have any hobbies in the arts. There's no music, no art, nothing like that. But they loved seeing me do it, and they completely encouraged me to do it, while very smartly encouraging me to make sure that I got a day job that I would enjoy while I was trying to get published. So they put a very realistic slant on it while always supporting me. And then throughout school, having teachers support me, and then got married, and my husband, very, very supportive, which is not always the case with writer spouses before you're published, but he was incredibly supportive. So,
is that Jeff?
It is, yes.
That's to whom you dedicate the book, right?
Yes, he gets a lot of books dedicated to him.
Yeah. Now, in the dedication, you say, it says here, for Jeff, who knew I needed a new story to tell and encouraged me to take the leap.
Yes.
Was that starting a new series specifically?
It was, yeah, because quite often when writers start a new series, it is because either they've run out of ideas or they've gotten tired of the characters or sales are dropping. I didn't have any of those three. I still had ideas. I still loved my characters and sales were still climbing. But I just knew that creatively it was time to wrap that up and start something new. And it was a very difficult decision to make. And he really did encourage me to do that. So I am grateful.
And the readers that you had for the Otherworld series, I mean, do you think they'll follow you to this new series?
Some of them certainly have already. I've heard from some of my betas saying, if you want beta readers, and I said, great, thank you, because I'm certainly not going to go to them and say, do you want a beta read, when I don't want to presume that they even want to read the series.
Yeah.
But that is nice to hear from them.
Well, when you started your career in writing, could you have imagined the career that you have today?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it took so long to get published, and it was years and years. I mean, I can say Bitten was my first book. No, it was my first published novel. It was my fourth completed novel. So years of trying to get something published, and all you're hoping for is to get a book on the shelf, and then you're hoping maybe someday you'll be able to write full time, and not ever dreaming of having New York Times on your best on your cover or anything like that, because it just seemed too big.
And I guess that was the Awakening. Was that the book that hit number one?
It was.
Yeah. I mean, well, what's that like when you find? I mean, you must get a call from an agent or someone like that, or from your publisher.
I can better remember when I first hit the New York Times, which was book 7 of The Otherworld, because I had been so close for a couple of years. I'd been on what they call the extended list, but they don't use it at that publisher until you hit the short list. So I was in my hotel room on tour when I got that call, and it was so good because, for all those years, slowly climbing and crossing fingers, and I had just switched from paperback original to hardcover, and I thought, well, this clearly means that it will be many more years before I hit the New York Times list. And I did it with that one, which was amazing. And then for the YA one, what I do recall is that the end of the first book is a cliffhanger. And I spent the entire year apologizing for that because readers would say, oh, I was so mad at the cliffhanger, I threw the book at the wall. And I would say, I'm so sorry. And then the second one hit number one, debuted at number one, and I stopped apologizing because I realized that while they, complained about cliffhangers, obviously they then ran out to buy the next one, which was wonderful.
Now, whenever you're written about, they tend to mention that you do better outside of Canada than at home. They write about Linwood Barclay in the same way. He blurbs your book, actually. Mm-hmm. Do you still seek, say, validation from home? And what do you think it is that you're not? I mean, the can-lit scene seems to look over Kelly Armstrong and her books.
Actually, these days I do very well in Canada, better than I do in the U.S., and that has just sort of flipped in the last few years.
Uh-huh.
So I think part of it was the YA bumping. Part of it was putting new covers on the books. There can be all these little things that will give it that bump that brings it up. But certainly for years and years, I was selling better in the UK and in the US than in the Canada. I just think that what I was writing wasn't catching on. And certainly when you think Canadian writers, you don't think genre writers. You think of canlit. So then you don't get that hometown bump.
Does it still matter, though, how one does at home?
It always does because, you know, certainly for me, I especially love hearing from Canadian readers. And I love going to your Canadian events and having them turn out for those. If you were to say, would I rather have a big crowd in Canada or the U.S.? Always Canada, because it just feels that much better.
Yeah. You already have a built-in audience, but I'm sure. I mean, all authors would like more and more readers as their books come out. Do you have someone in mind who would that you'd like to read Omens?
What I would like for with Omens is certainly because I've changed. I know that I will lose some readers. Those who are the die-hard werewolf, demon, vampire fans. That's not what this is. And those who are the diehard action, that's not what this is. It's lighter paranormal elements like omens, portents, second sight, and it's more mystery-based. So while I will lose them, then I'm looking at, well, okay, who do I hope to, you know, bring in? And I'm hoping that it's those who are okay with having their, you know, mystery having some paranormal elements. They're not really into the whole werewolves, vampires, that is too fantastical. But that they can accept things like somebody who can see omens or somebody who has the sight.
See, I read most of my books, most of the reading, I should say, I do at night, and just before I go to bed, most nights. And so I'm afraid that if I read your book, I won't be able to sleep. Is it one of those kinds of?
No, it's definitely not. I mean, I grew up loving horror, and I in my teens wrote horror, so I do love it. But there are very few of my books that actually have what I would consider frightening scenes at all, and most of them are actually in my teen books, because I find that audience devours it much more.
Yeah. You've got another book coming out this fall, is that right?
I do. I'm finally wrapping up my Nadia Stafford trilogy with the third and final book, which it's been a few years since the last one, because the YA took off, and I didn't have a time to wrap that up, so I'm very excited to finally finish it.
And the other YA series, I mean, those continue, will they?
They actually, I wrapped up my YA paranormal series, and I start next spring. My next YA trilogy is high fantasy based on medieval Japan.
And how do you get to a place like Japan in medieval times? I mean, is that something that interests you, or do you think that that'll interest the reader?
It's something that interests me. It always has to interest me. Somebody could say, you know, this is extremely popular, write it. For example, vampires.
Yeah.
Many times people said, Kelly, vampires are so hot. If you ever want to write a vampire book, now is the time. I didn't want to. So I can't make myself, and I won't make myself write something that is hot. So certainly for medieval Japan fascinates me. And now we've seen sort of a more acceptance of high fantasy in the general market with Game of Thrones. So you're sort of combining that and saying, okay, so a genre that I love is suddenly seeing more general acceptance, and I want to do something new in YA, and I love medieval Japan. How can I put those three things together?
And so far, Omens is doing well, right?
It is.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Continued good luck with the book.
Thank you.
The website for more, kellyarmstrong.com. The book is called Omens. It's published by Random House. It was in late August that Kelly Armstrong was on the line with me from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.